Good morning. May it please the court, Howard Goodfriend for the appellants, Swedish Hospital, Dr. Michael Shannon. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes if I could. The primary issue here is whether the trial court erred in allowing one of plaintiff's treating physicians to offer undisclosed expert testimony for the first time on rebuttal regarding experiments that she had performed to rebut the defense theory of the case. The jury found Dr. Shannon and Swedish negligent for leaving a narrow gauge wire, a guide wire, in 20-month-old Jackson Swain, and awarded Jackson and his parents $1 million in general damages in the absence really of any evidence that the guide wire caused any permanent or even temporary illness or injury. The plaintiff's theory here was that Dr. Shannon, who had placed thousands of central lines into patients, somehow forgot to remove this guide wire after inserting a catheter into a vein in Jackson's leg. And the defense was that Dr. Shannon used a 40-centimeter Cook wire, Cook is the manufacturer, that had separated at the welds, and that when he pulled out the wire, what remained was the coiled sheathing. This explained why when the wire was removed, it was found to be 50 centimeters in length when it was pulled out. And it also explained why the two pathologists, treating pathologists, who examined the wires when they were removed, noted in their report that they had a coiled architecture. Dr. Chapman, the radiologist, was disclosed by plaintiffs as a treating fact witness, a treating radiologist.
But can't treating witnesses render expert opinions?
They can. They absolutely can. But those expert opinions have to be disclosed. And it was not disclosed here.
Well, wasn't a fair reading of her report that she thought it was a wire?
She testified, and her report basically stated that two thin metallic densities in the chest consistent with wires were observed. That's in Exhibit 6. She was identified as a fact witness, as a treating radiologist, to testify to the care and treatment of Jackson. There was no other expert testimony offered. And the defense, in fact, chose not to depose her because the testimony was essentially non-controversial. It was her observation as a radiologist.
But wouldn't her opinion that it was a wire go to the essence of the defense, though?
She could testify that it was a wire, and she could testify to what she observed, but that's not what she testified to, and that's not what the trial court found in its remarks on the motion for new trial was so devastating, and those were the trial court's words. She, in fact, tested, after she had learned of the defense theory of the case, coils and guide wire samples that she had received from plaintiff's counsel, and determined that the wires had smooth margins, and she compared radiologic images of the coil with the wire and told the jury that what she saw in Jackson was definitely a wire and not a coil based upon different densities of these observations. That is not the testimony of a treating physician. That's the testimony of an expert, and it was not disclosed. A fact witness is one whose testimony is derived from the treatment of plaintiff rather than on scientific or technical experiments. She said in her report that she observed a wire, but there was no indication that she knew anything about coils or that she, in fact, tested them, that they had different densities whatsoever. And this was doubly prejudicial to the defense. It was amplified many times by the fact that plaintiff called Dr. Chapman not in their case in chief, but as a witness on rebuttal to which the defense could not respond.
Why doesn't the trial court always have the ability to decide the order of proof in the way the story will make the most sense to the jury? I mean, where's the case law that defines it's got to go direct, defense, rebuttal, and defines what's within each of those? I mean, the rules of evidence give the trial court discretion to decide the order of proof.
There's no question that the trial court has substantial discretion in allowing rebuttal testimony. But what the trial court does not have the discretion to do is to allow on rebuttal expert testimony that was never previously disclosed and that could not be met by the defense. Had it been disclosed, she would have been deposed, and the defense would have been able to put it on in the defense portion of the case. The defense, in fact, timely objected not just Originally, they objected to the fact that she wasn't a proper rebuttal before they knew about these expert experiments that she had conducted. And the trial court denied and said, well, she can testify that, you know, what she saw is a wire. But when she got on the stand and talked about how she had conducted, you know, radiologic experiments, basically, on a coil versus a wire, that was, in fact, what the trial court found was so devastating to the defense. The defense timely objected to this. It moved to strike it, and it moved for a new trial based upon the fact that they had no opportunity to respond to it. Now, you know, under Fison's, where there has been a nondisclosure, there has to be, and where it's devastating, as the trial court found here, there has to be some remedy to allow the other side to rebut it. There was none granted here. And
did the defense ask for something other than exclusion? I mean, like time, sir rebuttal, something else?
No, not at this stage. I mean, this was at the very end of trial.
The defense didn't have a witness at this point in time to rebut her testimony, did it?
No, because it didn't know, you know, the defense did not have any knowledge that there was going to be this testimony about radiologic comparisons of densities between coils and wires. That, you know, the defense called the pathologists who both testified that what they saw was coiled architecture. It called a metallurgist to testify to the fact that these guide wires can, in fact, fail at the welds, and that this was a perfectly plausible theory that was, in fact, consistent with other failures that the trial court also didn't let the defense expert testify to based upon these MAUD reports, and that's our second issue. But I mean, that just amplifies the prejudice and shows that, you know, on the very last day of trial, when you have a rebuttal witness getting up and offering expert testimony that no one has had the chance to meet or rebut, the sanction has to be directing the jury to disregard that testimony and striking it, if in fact they allow it in the first instance. And we objected to the fact as soon as she started going into it. So we asked to reverse and for a new trial.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Leonard Feldman, and I'm counsel for the plaintiffs. The jury in this case didn't find the defendants liable because of any undisclosed expert testimony, because of any improper rebuttal. It found the defendants liable because Dr. Shannon left a guide wire inside of a patient. And the only defense that the defendants had, which is that this is what was left inside of the patient, didn't square with the testimony of the doctor that pulled the wire out of the patient. And he pulled out a wire, not a flimsy coil. There's absolutely no reason to believe that the result on remand would be any different than the result that was reached here. And in fact, there's no error. And the standard review is either abuse of discretion or manifest abuse of discretion. And there's certainly none of that. So let's look at Dr. Chapman's testimony. First of all, it's very important to recognize, as the court already has, she's not a fact witness. She is a treating physician fact witness. And the Washington Supreme Court has explained that that's different. Treating physician fact witnesses get to provide testimony in the form of an opinion.
But the comparison or experiment, however you wanted to characterize it, about wire versus coil, that wasn't part of her duties or experience as a treating radiologist. That came later.
Yeah, but I think the defendants here are confusing the testimony, the opinion itself, on the one hand, with the bases for it. And let me just say that when we're talking about a treating physician fact witness, the only disclosure obligation is that the person's going to testify. So the opinion here is that these were wires. And when Dr. Chapman said these were wires, she concluded that it wasn't a scalpel, it wasn't a train, it wasn't an airplane, it wasn't a coil. She ruled all those out when she said these were wires. Now, she could testify to that effect on a number of grounds. I imagined in my head what this would look like if I put it under an X-ray. I did this 3 years ago. I remember what it looks like under an X-ray. I spoke to one of my colleagues. I did a Google search. I looked at my medical books.
Do we make a distinction between conduct she engaged in after she wrote her note that said it was a wire and the knowledge she had accumulated up to that point in time?
Courts have never done that. And again, this goes back to the Smith opinion, which describes...
The reason I ask my question is, one would seem to explain why she reached the opinion she did when she wrote the note. The other is a search for corroboration after the fact.
Yeah, and to answer your question, there's no case law that indicates that when a treating physician fact witness wants to be prepared to testify knowledgeably at trial, that the treating physician fact witness can't do any of the things that I just mentioned. What matters is whether the opinion itself is derived from the treatment. So the opinion here was these are wires, not coils. Everything else is just the basis for that witness's opinion. And if the witness were an expert, there'd be a disclosure obligation, but the witness wasn't an expert because the opinions were and remained derived from the treatment. So the remedy here is the same remedy that defendants have with regard to fact witnesses. Depose them. This was disclosed. The content of Dr. Chapman's testimony was disclosed months before trial. They had a report. And after opening statements, Mr. Wampold in the trial court said, Dr. Chapman's going to be here. She's going to testify on rebuttal that these are wires and these aren't coils. And they had every opportunity to take a deposition, which, of course, is precisely what they insisted upon when they were disclosing their witnesses on the eve of trial. And we took those depositions. So there was no unfair surprise at our end.
So did plaintiff depose people during trial?
Indeed, plaintiff did. Marshall, the gentleman that testified that this was a cook wire, was deposed during trial. And that could have happened with Dr. Chapman, or they could have gone out in the hallway and just interviewed her and figured out what she was going to say. And this notion that they didn't have witnesses available, that's just not true. Dr. Larson was available. Mr. Klein was available. They had a number of remedies that they could have, and under Burnett, must have, asked this trial court at the time, these are some lesser restrictive alternatives than complete exclusion. And so one of those would have been to bring in somebody on surrebuttal. But the point that we made in our brief is that that didn't come up because the defendants never said to the trial court, A, you should do a Burnett analysis because we think that this is undisclosed expert testimony, and B, here's why it's prejudicial, here's why there's willfulness, neither of which they could have established, but C, here's a lesser restrictive alternative. And the notion that that can be done after trial, which is the argument that the defendants make in their reply brief, at that point it's too late to do any of those things. So, yes, they could have brought in a surrebuttal witness, and no, they didn't even bother to ask. So even if this court were to find that this is expert testimony, we still have the problem that they can't establish prejudice, and they never asked for the Burnett analysis. Now, on the issue of rebuttal, that's a pretty simple issue, because now all we're talking about is not whether the testimony comes in, but does it come in early or does it come in late? And the trial court judge had a very reasonable approach in exercising her discretion on this, which is that the plaintiff's case was all about wires. And it wasn't until the defense put on their case that they were going to start talking about this coil. It wouldn't have made any sense to the jury to have a rebuttal witness testify in the case in chief, you haven't heard the defense yet, but here's what we think they're going to say. And assuming they say what we think they're going to say, here is how we would respond. And trial courts deal with this issue all the time. There has to be some logic to the story. So in this particular case, the story is Dr. Shannon left a wire inside of a patient, and the doctor who took it out took out a wire. Defendants were going to come in, and they were going to say, no, it was a coil. And they were going to specifically attack Dr. Chapman's opinion as a radiologist that what she saw was actually this and not a wire. And so Dr. Chapman logically should be able to come in on rebuttal and say, no, they're wrong. I was right. I concluded that this was a wire, and when I did that, I necessarily concluded it wasn't a coil. And here are a dozen reasons why I know that to be true. And none of that changes it into expert testimony.
With regard to the MOD reports and the defense metallurgist, did the trial court exclude it because the plaintiff provided, defense counsel provided the reports? I mean, does it matter who gives the reports to the expert? I mean, can an expert use that as a basis to either to establish its own opinion or impeach somebody else's opinion?
Yeah, but to answer your question, the central thrust of the trial court's ruling was the ER 703. This is a witness who, on cross-examination, and when asked these questions by the trial court judge, literally could not identify a single metallurgist who had relied on MOD reports in doing their work or giving their testimony. So that was the central thrust of what the trial court said. But she went on to note that it really bothered her that this was a witness who, when he testified, the impression she got was he had no idea what a MOD report was until defendant's counsel handed him these MOD reports before he testified. And he was asked, did you go out and get any other MOD reports? And he said, I couldn't. So we know in Washington law, the Washington Supreme Court has held, and I think this court has held, that when doing an ER 703 analysis, courts are not limited just to whether somebody can show that, you know, other experts have relied on it. There's a credibility determination.
Well, let me ask you, even if he had relied on them independently, what overcomes a hearsay objection? Just because an expert relies on something doesn't make what he relies upon admissible.
And I agree with that, too. And that would be another basis for the trial court to exclude these. So what we have is, I would say, four different grounds. The ER 703 grounds, the credibility and reliability grounds, the hearsay issue that you've identified, and then, as we pointed out, there's also a federal statute that says these reports cannot, quote, otherwise be used in private litigation. And then if you get through all of that, you've got the issue of they have not and they cannot show prejudice because Mr. Klein was able to give all of his testimony anyway. So, again, no error, no manifest abuse of discretion, no abuse of discretion, no prejudice. We ask that the court affirm.
Thank you.
Addressing the testimony of Dr. Chapman first, she was disclosed to testify to her treatment of the plaintiff. The defense was provided a report regarding her findings that there are two metallic densities in the chest consistent with wires. The defense called, in its case, an expert radiologist, and he testified that Dr. Shannon removed inner wires after the weld holding the inner wire to the outer sheathing separated, and he basically looked at the films and said that the weld was not observable in the film, and therefore it likely failed. So what is Dr. Chapman's testimony on rebuttal? And it's on page 74. Dr. Chapman, since learning about the defense theory of this coiled portion coming off, have you examined the guide wire to see the coiled portion separated from the central wire? Yes, I have. Do you believe it's possible that the coiled portion stretched out and were not guide wires? It's not possible. I have actually seen what a coil looks like under a radiograph. It has a different texture to it. It literally looks like a slinky kind of coil. It is radio dense, but not quite as dense as this. It does not have smooth margins. So this is what she testified to.
Is that an experiment or simply another aspect of her underlying opinion that it was a wire, not a coil?
It was not part of her underlying opinion when she treated the patient.
How do we know that?
Because that was what she said. She had examined them since learning about the defense theory of this coiled.
Well, she's gone back and reexamined the radiographic study, perhaps, but how do we know it isn't the same fund of knowledge that caused her to write consistent with wire in her first note?
Because she says, I have examined what coils looks like under a radiograph. This was something that she did after
Well, she wasn't cross-examined, so how do we know that it was something she did after as opposed to before?
Because I think had she done it before, it would have been in her report. All she did was review.
We have to speculate to figure out when she did it, don't we?
I think you read this testimony, and it's really susceptible only to one possible conclusion, and it was never denied by the plaintiff that that's exactly what she did. She looked at these things after she learned of the defense theory of the case.
In what context would the plaintiff have denied it if she wasn't cross-examined?
In the context of the argument about its admissibility. This was objected to at the time it was offered. The defense made a timely motion to strike, and then they did it again in their motion for a new trial. And never once was there any implication that this was part of her treatment of Jackson. It was prejudicial, it was undisclosed, and it's reversible error. Thank you.
Thank you. Arzola and Name Intelligence.